everyone. Welcome. This is episode 323 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. It's part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, joined by Ryan and Paul. We're starting our big season preview, our 2024 season preview with this episode. We'll be focusing on the Brewers offense. We'll do pitching next week, and then we'll wrap things up the weekend before opening day with some predictions and kind of putting a bow on all that. But first of all, guys, how's things been going this weekend? Paul, I know it's daylight savings weekend and always tough for parents.
Yeah, it's been rough. We did have one fun event where people may have gotten overserved and then daylight savings happened. Yeah. That's fine. Good and bad balance out. But yeah, kids have trouble adjusting to the sleep schedule when this happens every single time. It's very annoying. All parents know this. And it just screws up your general timelines on things.
Well, I made a huge screw up where I thought that Liverpool was going to start at 9:45 this morning because normally there's a 6-hour time difference between the United States and the UK. So a 3:45 start there should mean a 9:45 start here in Milwaukee. And guess what? That's not true because they don't do daylight savings time for another 2 weeks. So I got completely screwed up. We were at the bar. We walked into to have breakfast at Three Lions up in Whitefish Bay. And we walked in and there was like nobody in there. And we're going, wow, whatever. And then it turns out that actually, the game is not for another almost 2 hours because, yeah. And then I get a text message from Steve because I had invited him to join us. I get a text message from him and he goes, so did you figure it out? And I'm like, he realized that I had screwed this up and didn't say anything to me and left me twisting in the wind. And my wife, I told her, and she's just like, God damn it. So yeah, that was the start of my day. And it was an insanely wonderful match. I'm so sad to be on the other side of these Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp matches because they are just the best every time, even though Liverpool once again got screwed at the death, but whatever, it's a draw. They're still in the title race. But yeah, it was a very, very exciting game and a lot of fun, even though the ending wasn't as much as we would have liked.
I just watched a lot of basketball today, and unfortunately that included the Badgers. So yeah, that's rough, but it's heading into the favorite time of year for me, March Madness, championship week. A lot of fun for that. So
They hung with Purdue on the road.
So I'm looking forward to wagering against Purdue in the tournament. They're such frauds, just enormous, enormous basketball frauds. And as soon as they run into like normal officiating, not good, bad, et cetera, just normal, they're going to get destroyed by some team early.
Yeah. You know, it's bad when Robbie Hummel on Play by Play, Purdue legend, says, yeah, the officiating's been bad today. Yeah, but I'm looking forward to brackets, all that stuff. But hey, let's talk baseball because we've got a bunch of questions to get to, a lot to get through. So a reminder, as always, even on these preview episodes, patrons get question priority. Go to patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month gets you that question priority, both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. $5 gets you that perk, plus the additional exclusive podcasts, including the Minor League Extra with Ryan and James Anderson of RotoWire. All right, so as I mentioned at the top, going position by position around the diamond today. So let's start behind the dish. Last year, obviously, William Contreras, big success story there. And Vic Caratini carried the entire load at catcher. It's still wild to me that they used only two catchers all year last year.
It's insane.
And those two, they led all of baseball in team catcher Fangraphs WAR at 6.1. Of course, Vic Caratini's gone. He's gone to Houston. In his place, we've got Gary Sanchez, and manager Pat Murphy is talking a lot about Eric Haas and how he's going to figure into the mix along with Jefferson Caro, who's now on the 40-man roster. So we're going to be using Fangraphs roster resource depth charts to kind of, look at these projections and see how they figure compared to last year's final numbers. So the depth charts, roster resource depth charts, I should say, has the Brewers slipping to sixth in baseball catcher WAR at 4.1. So I guess, Paul, let's start there. Does that fit with your expectations? They lose a little bit with Caratini, maybe some defensive versatility behind Contreras, but what do you think?
I actually think they'll overperform that and probably handily, if for no other reason than Fangraphs and probably prospectus too, but probably underrate the Brewers' ability to improve catcher defense. And even when you're not dealing with people who aren't butchers, like they'll probably, like Gary Sanchez will probably have a better defensive year than he generally has, even if it's just a couple of little minor upgrades out there. I could see them taking a little bit of a step back just because Contreras still does have a tendency to hit the ball on the ground a lot. And, you know, that can, we may have a little bit of offensive regression from him, possibly. But, you know, the opposite is true, too. People work on things like that, and he could have a huge offensive explosion. I'm very confident that their catcher position will be excellent in total as they mix and match people and maybe get Jefferson Caro in there later in the year. And I think they'll probably still be one of, like, the five best catcher war teams in baseball, if not the best again.
Yeah, that all seems fair. I think I'm a little less bullish on them. Like, I wouldn't say I expect handily, but, you know, being around five would make a lot of sense. Yeah. I think Sanchez is good. He's going to see a significant amount of time at DH. We know that. That's where that's going to head. And he actually did finally get into a game this weekend. Actually, I had a schedule. I was just reading about that before we started. But he hasn't been catching yet. So we'll have to see how that shakes out. But yeah, I think that the Brewers are going to have one of the best catching situations in baseball again this year. And they're really deep. I like the depth, obviously, that they have here. When Jefferson Caro is your fourth catcher, you're doing pretty damn good for yourself in terms of depth. So I like it. But it's difficult whenever you have a season like this where you put up like a 6.1 when you are on that, like the best team in baseball sort of thing, especially at a position where you're going to have to get performances from multiple guys. This isn't a place where you could have some guy go out and play 160 games. It's just not how catcher works. And so there's going to have to be multiple players in here, probably more than two, because that would be insane if they did that again. But yeah, I think that you would expect a little bit of a regression from that. I would take the under on the 6.1, over on 4.1, comfortably in the middle somewhere, right around, I think in that top five makes a lot of sense to me.
I mean, they might have more than two catchers on the opening day roster if things go the way they've been going, right? Like with Murphy talking up Haas, and Haas has been getting a lot of playing time. Granted, that's also because Sanchez has been on the shelf. I know I brought it up a couple of times. Either of you think maybe it's looking more likely, at least at times, they'll have three catchers on the roster?
Looking a little more likely, but I also, I try not to listen to too much spring training banter in seriousness. A lot of coach speak in spring training is talking guys up and making sure everybody stays motivated. And I guess, like, nothing against Eric Haas, but I'll believe he is real once I actually see him. And I do think they'll keep him around for depth, because I do think there's some, like, maybe minor injury stuff with Sanchez that they want to at least have an insurance policy for, and may end up, like, I think last week I predicted he'd start on the opening day roster and then be gone a week later. But I don't think he'll be a huge portion of the team for the totality of the season. Like, a guy who's just around once in a while. The four war will be much more correct if Eric Haas plays a lot, and I don't think he will.
Yeah, I think he will see time, but I would expect that to be under a month's worth as opposed to over a month's worth.
Yeah.
I like, give me the under on 20 games in the majors as opposed to the over. Of course, injury can change that, especially early injury. If you get a late injury, that increases the chances that it would be Caro who would step in. But early on, it's going to be Haas who would be the primary, third catcher there. If Sanchez isn't ready to go, Jay Google's been pushing this a lot lately. Yeah, if Gary Sanchez isn't ready to go out of the gate, then Eric Haas is going to have to catch off the bench. But then again, early on, the Brewers don't necessarily need, because of all the off days they have early on, they only play five of their first 8 days of the season. So they don't probably have to use a backup catcher for the first, almost like 10 days of the season. They could probably just get away with like having the off days be Contreras's off days, and that would be fine. So, cause they don't play more than two games in a row until like that second weekend of the season. So yeah.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, moving from a position of strength and one of the best in the majors to a major weakness and one that was one of the worst in the majors, first base. So obviously, the addition of Rhys Hoskins, one of the major headlines of the offseason, something Ryan was pulling for weeks, if not months there, that should help boost them from the negative 0.6 Fangraphs score they put up there last year, which amazingly wasn't last place, only ranked 27th in the majors. So a lot of bad first base play, it seems, but still.
Yeah.
So the bad... Bat will help, but Hoskins' defense kind of drags down his and the team projection, though. So Fangraphs, roster resource, depth charts projecting them for 21st in the majors. Hey, that's an improvement in 1.5 Fangraphs war. So I guess the question here at this position, will Rhys Hoskins' offense be good enough to make his presence in the lineup far outweigh the downsides on defense? And then also, I guess, how much are you guys expecting to see, like, the Jake Bowers and Tyler Blacks of the world there as well?
Yeah, I think that I'm starting to expect maybe a little bit more of it. I think I'm starting to lean towards we're going to see more Hoskins at DH than maybe I was expecting because of how much Tyler Black has been playing at first base and how much other stuff has been going on over at third. So we'll get to that shortly, but... Yeah, I think that there's a good chance we're going to see more non-Rhys Hoskins at first and more Hoskins at DH down the stretch this season, especially if the Sal Frelick thing turns out to be true. So
yeah,
we will see how that all ends up working out. But yeah, I mean, Hoskins is not a good defender at first base. He's a bad defender at first base, and it does hurt his overall production, but that's not why we got Rhys Hoskins. We got Rhys Hoskins to be a stalwart in the middle of the lineup, and he seems to already be doing that in spring training. He hasn't played a ton, but he is hitting the ball for power and coming off the injury situation like he did. I did want to see him actually, you know, hitting the ball hard and slugging it around. That was something that I was hoping to see, and having him go out there and he has a couple home runs this spring. In only 15 plate appearances, he has a couple home runs. So, yeah, that is definitely, 15 at-bats. I hate how MLB does that for spring training stats. Just give me the PAs, no, guys. Come on, what is this, the time of Charlemagne? Yeah, so, but Hoskins is there because he is a power bat for the middle of the lineup, and he's going to do that. He seems to have recovered that way. So I'm feeling good about that. Whether it's at first base or DH, I kind of don't care. I just want that power bat in the middle of our lineup.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right projection-wise, just because Hoskins is a good bat, and that's why he's there. But that, like, let's just assume for a second he played 162 games. I think that's about what you'd get, a little over that from most Hoskins seasons, with some ceiling on that. Like, I think... Yeah, if he had a good Hoskins season, you could get like a 3-WAR season out of him. But, you know, behind him, the depth is a little rocky. Like, the Brewers have also shown willingness to play random weirdos at first base, like Owen Miller. So, like, you're going to get dragged down a little bit by that. Jake Bowers is, like, he's terrible. He's not a good player. So I hope he does not play very much, but that's not awe-inspiring. You might get a little bit more from Tyler Black, just because that bat actually is, I think, decent and maybe better than that. And first base is, you know, as we've mentioned many times, he might not be able to stick at third. So let's give this a shot and see how it goes. But like, I think 1.5 to 2-ish WAR is probably about right for this current first base situation. Like, they're going to weave in people and use the DH to take Hoskins' bat out of the position with some regularity. And so it's not going to be an overwhelming positive for the team. It's just not.
Yeah, Black's defense at first base does seem to be pretty good. He seems to be catching on over there, which you would expect. It's sort of the deal with him.
So yeah, I think he's good at the catching part and even the lateral movement part. So just the throwing.
Yeah, which at first base is a minimal sort of thing that you have to worry about. So that's good. I think we do end up seeing him, a sizable amount of him. Definitely rooting to see more of him than of Jake Bowers, but whatever. I mean, if Jake Bowers makes the open day roster, it's not the end of the world. These things are all subject to change.
Yeah.
All right, let's skip over second base for a minute, hop over to shortstop. That's a little bit more settled, at least, I guess, for now. Willy Adames is still a Brewer, so he returns, playing the position. His performance carried to 11th in the majors last year by Fangraphs WAR. Despite offense that ranked 17th, the defense was 4th. that really kind of speaks to, you know, the high floor that you get with Willy Adames there defensively, at least. The big questions here are, can Adames, you know, find his bat, have that offense rebound a little bit, once again, make him one of the very best shortstops in the league overall? And then, of course, how long will he be with the club since he's ticketed for free agency after this year? So, Paul, I guess, how long do you think Willy Adames is a Brewer? The entire year, or is he shipped off in July?
He's a tough one because I feel like he's very situational dependent. And, like, they clearly will move people when it suits their needs. They're probably a little bit more willing to get rid of Corbin just because there's probably a little inkling of personal stuff there just with the arbitration anger and whatnot. Willie seems, you know, he's a better guy. You want Willie on your team. So that leans just a hair more in favor of keeping him. But like, I don't think that, like, not to get ahead of myself projection wise, but I think there's a better than average chance that they're going to actually be struggling a little bit this year around the trade deadline more than they usually are. And so maybe move, but I think he'll be on the team to start the season. I think there's a good chance he plays the whole season with the team. If it's not anything innovative to say, if they're struggling, they'll trade somebody to trade that line. That's just how baseball works. But I think we could, like, projecting wise, we should count on him being on the team because, frankly, if it goes to hell, then there'll be an entirely different analysis anyway. And Willie's great. He is not the best bat at shortstop, but by all metrics, he's super elite at defense. And by prospectuses, like metrics they rolled out last year, he was like in a tier unto himself defensively. Mm-hmm. So yeah. He has a great floor. He's only 27. This will be his age 28 season. He's not going to be slowing down athletically. He's actually kind of a weird athlete because he's not very fast, but man, he's quick, twitchy as all get out. And so, like, I think, you know, count on him being on the team for now. This is going to be about right, and they'll still have an elite defensive performance at that position, I think, kind of no matter who's playing it, because even the shortstop depth is likely to be also quite good at playing shortstop.
I want to be careful about how I word this, but yeah. I would not at all be surprised if a big part of why they want to hold on to Willy Adames at this point is because they're breaking in so many young players that they want somebody like Willy Adames around, who is such a, like, a focal point in the clubhouse. Everybody talks about how great he is and how, like, a wonderful leader and example he is to people, and also just how he keeps everything light. He seems like a guy that you want in the center of everything. You already kind of talked about this, Paul. He yeah. seems like that kind of guy. And so I think, you know, especially with the fact that, like, they're breaking in a number of Latino players as well, and, like, that could be an additional thing for, you know, a benefit of Willie. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, maybe that becomes less of an issue by midseason if they are out of it, and if they are looking like a team that needs to make a trade. I think they could do that. As far as the offense goes, looking at the roster resource projections, because I didn't put it in the rundown there, this is one I missed that on. They have him hitting .244, .324, .450, which feels like very much like that's a drive straight down the middle of the fairway, isn't it? Like, that's,
yeah, totally.
That sounds exactly right. Like .244, .324, .450. Yeah, that sounds right. And it's also, it would be, you know, quite fine. It's a WOBA of .332. You know, it's solidly above average for a shortstop, but not, you know, remarkably so. He's just a good, solid offensive player to go with his normal, really good defense. They have him getting 3.7 Fangraphs WAR at shortstop, and the Brewers being 10th in shortstop WAR. That, if that all holds up, that would be, you know, a key piece to, if they do contend this year, that would be key to doing that, right?
Yeah, it would.
Absolutely. Yep. All right. Popping over to second base, strong spot defensively, at least last year. They ranked 8th in Fangraphs defensively, but of course, much, much worse at the plate. Only the Rockies and White Sox were worse at second base offensively last year. Bryce Terang, the main reason for both of those things. But the Brewers have also now brought in a couple of other players to maybe push him and, you know, force a little bit of competition here. So we've got Andrew Monasterio from last year's team back, who's a possibility there, but they've also got Joey Ortiz, speaking of the Corbin Burnes trade, looking to play up the middle a little bit, and Oliver Dunn, who, you know, was minor league superstar, fall league breakout last year, but not the best defensive second baseman. They're talking maybe more third for him. But I guess all things considered, Ryan, how do you see the playing time breaking down at second base, at least to start the year?
Yeah, I think I'm really leaning towards this being Joey Ortiz's job primarily, especially after this weekend. Pat Murphy mentioned that Oliver Dunn is more ticketed for third. He's more comfortable over there. So if Oliver Dunn makes the opening day roster, he would be seeing more time at third base as opposed to second. I think this is kind of going to be Joey Ortiz's job for the most part, with, you know, a decent amount of Bryce Terang. Like, Terang is going to be the primary backup, and we'll get some time here and at shortstop, and hell, probably at third base as well. But yeah, I think this is pretty much going to be Joey Ortiz's job. And you know, barring a very surprising extension for Willy Adames, I think it would be qualifies as a surprise at this point if Willy Adames was extended. I think Joey Ortiz is your opening day shortstop for the 2025 Brewers, and it might be sooner than that, honestly.
Yep, agree with all of that. And I think Ortiz will get the majority of playing time at second base and represent, frankly, an enormous upgrade. I don't think Joey Ortiz, like, there's potential in that bat, but even if he doesn't reach the potential with that bat, he should still be in just incredible offensive upgrade over mostly Terang last year. And by all accounts is, you know, in the same ballpark defensively. So this should be a position where they have a war gain from last year, which is nice to see. And Terang is, I think, much better suited as a backup anyway, because he does have tools that are useful. He is a stud defensively. He is incredibly fast, and, you know, can do things with his speed that a lot of other guys can't. So I think this is a significant upgrade for the position. I agree with Don too. I feel like he's going to end up being part of the third base mismatch as well. Mismatch, not match. But second base should be fun this year.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about this is normally you would think, well, you're going to have to give up some defense to gain offense here. But with Joey Ortiz, if anything, he might be better than Terang defensively at second base, because he's also a really elite defender, even, you know, more so than Terang. So it's like you have to give up a bunch of defense here to get Joey Ortiz on the field. You're probably getting just as much defense, but you are almost certainly getting, you know, a better offensive player than Terang. I think that is pretty likely, yeah.
All right, Terang is the topic of our first Patreon question this week. Comes from Luke Corey's Suitcase, who's asking, is Bryce Terang at an age where he could still unlock more power? What's his ceiling at this point, and are there places he could improve? So, Ryan, any hope that he kind of taps into something here?
Yeah, I am the all-time Bryce Terang honk here. And yeah, there is a chance for that. I think Keith Law talked about it a few years ago now, that he thought that Bryce Terang, once he learned which pitches to start really attacking, that he could potentially have as much as 15 to 20 home run per year power. And we did see Terang put up 13 home runs playing in one of the most home run suppressing environments in AAA. And the biggest thing here is, though, that Bryce Terang is, you know, not yet 25 years old. He's 24. Yeah. And so there is time. But for that to really change, he's going to have to start hitting the ball harder, which means, like, I don't know, an increase in bat speed, an increase in quality, barreling the baseball. Like, if you go to StatCast and look at his numbers, they are so blue. It is
chilly.
Yes, it's freezing cold. You get cold just looking at his. Yeah. Yes, you get cold just looking at his StatCast page, because he's just not making hard contact very much. He has to get better at that. Now, you can hit home runs. There are guys who hit like actually a decent number of home runs without making a ton of hard contact, but they have to be very selective and like attack certain pitches and just, you know, look to like yank them down the line and whatever. Usually it's, you know, extreme pull power and just try to yank one down the line. I think Terang can kind of do that, but to be a decent offensive player, to be of the kind of player who you would want starting for a first division club and not just like a second division starter or a bench player or platoon player, he's going to have to start hitting the ball harder. There's just no other way around it.
Yeah. All he's got left going for him is that he's still in the projectability rate, like age group. Like he is still young, but there's not any indication that there's going to be anything unlocked with him anytime soon. There's just a lot of problems with his swing, approach, etc. And, you know, it's just pure speculation to say that he could do that. So the answer is, yeah, it's possible. He's young enough. You can still learn things at that age. But there's not a lot of, you know, underlying signs that anything like that's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I'm not entirely optimistic on that. But like Ryan said, it's been there before. So maybe as he gets more confident or whatever, just kind of cuts loose. He's got nothing to lose. So may as well start swinging harder. Moving over to third base, as we mentioned, a lot of, similarities here, at least between the guys that may be bouncing between second and third. You've got, as we mentioned, Joey Ortiz, a possibility there, Monasterio, Oliver Dunn, also potentially Tyler Black, as you guys mentioned there. And, of course, the ultimate wild card and Sal Frelich, who Pat Murphy just said on Sunday is not getting enough emphasis or attention for what he's doing at third base so far this spring. So sounds like this might be getting more real as the days go by, at least Pat Murphy's impressed so far. So I guess whatever combination they end up using there, the question here, can the offense improve enough from its 20th in baseball mark last year, according to Fangraphs, without dropping too far down from the defensive rankings where they were 12th in the majors last year. So I guess, Paul, again, another offense for defense trade-off here, possibly?
Possibly so, although this position is so up in the air and there are so many people that can and will play it over the course of the season that it's almost hard to even say that with any confidence. Mm-hmm. Like, we think that Joey Ortiz will end up playing mostly second base, but if he plays enough over there, that boosts its defensive underlying stats pretty significantly, not even at the cost of second if Terang ends up over there for some reason. Well, Black is, by all accounts, not great over there. I think he is he's a tricky one because he's good enough at, I think, everything on third base except just arm strength. And I do care about that. You need a good one at third base, but it's not the end of the world. And who knows what Sal... The Frelich thing is like, it could be anything. Maybe he's a savant and he'll be one of the best third basemen in baseball. Maybe he'll never play it once in the regular season. How do you even project that? So I'm actually surprised they were so highly ranked at third base last year, honestly. I know Monasterio had a good year. But if they come under that, I won't be that surprised just because I have no idea what's going to go on here. That said, this is a franchise that's good at mixing and matching. Like, they're good at playing platoons over there. They're good at subbing in defense when they need it over there. And as long as they're willing to be versatile at the hot corner, they can probably squeeze out something similar to last year's production, if not a little bit better. This is the position that has the widest variance on the team, I think, without question, going into next year. Could be anything. I don't even know what to tell you. I would put them right on this projection because it seems like a good median, but I would put no money on wagering on third base for the Brewers in any capacity.
Yeah, this is just a complete like wild card situation. Third base, we didn't even talk about Brock Wilkin yet, who is the coming guy at third base. It could be there as soon as, late this season, honestly. If things were to work out well for him at AA and AAA during the season, I could see him coming up and late in the season and kind of getting ready for maybe a rookie of the year run next year. It is a completely wild situation. It could be just about anything. But the way that Pat Murphy was talking, the way I read those quotes, and I did not hear them, I only saw them, but the way I read those quotes was Pat Murphy wants this to happen. So if Pat Murphy wants it to happen, I think there's a good chance it's going to happen, or we're going to see a power struggle between the manager and the front office. So stay tuned, because this could get very interesting in terms of what's going on there. Because remember, it was Murphy who was the driving force of getting Frelich to start working at, on the infield. Though, remember, that story was he was working at second base because it was with...
Yeah, Dustin Pedroia.
It was with Pedroia and all that, which is why that got written about, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, this is one of those interesting situations where this could be just about anything. I honestly don't even know. And they do have, you look at the Fangraphs depth charts on this, and they really have a lot of different guys seeing time at third base for the Brewers this year, because you know, they don't know either what this is actually going to work out to be. Let's see. They have it breaking down as Joey Ortiz as the number one, getting 175. Frelick getting 168. Monasterio, 161. Tyler Black, 126. Owen Miller, 42. Oliver Dunn, 14. And Vinny Capra getting 7. So they have 8 different guys getting plate appearances at third base for the Brewers, and one of them is not Brock Wilkin.
Yeah.
So who the hell knows what's going to happen at third base? This is just going to be fascinating to watch because this could go so many different directions. It's probably going to honestly go a long way towards like telling the story of their season, right? Like this, and I think one of the outfield positions we're going to get to in a minute is really going to tell the story of the season in large part. So the third base thing is just, it's cuckoo bananas.
Yeah, I mean, if any one of those guys sticks and plays well, obviously I feel a lot better about the Brewers' chances this year than if it's just that rotating cycle of just trying to find a hot hand. It's trickier to find sustained success that way. All right, a couple of Patreon questions regarding third base. First, we have Jay Google, who's asking, Ryan, why does Fangraphs hate Tyler Black?
Oh, yeah, so the Tyler Black thing. So Tyler Black got ranked 10th. Nobody else had him outside of their top five, but he got ranked 10th by Eric Longenhagen. And he was pretty clear about the reasons. I mean, one, the defensive problems. He just doesn't feel like he has a good defensive home. I think he also mentioned that like he thinks if he's in another organization, he'd probably already be in an outfield corner and might actually look pretty good there. But that's just not a thing the Brewers, you know, can really do. So like, there's good trade possibility here for Tyler Black. And maybe that's what does this, is that can potentially break the logjam. But there was also another big concerning thing here. He thinks he has a pretty big hole in his swing and that pitchers are going to be able to pound him with fastballs high and outside until he proves that he can hit those. And I know instantly everybody flashed to Keston Hira and you start thinking of that. I don't know if it's the same sort of problem. I mean, would you say Keston Hira has an arm bar or like I'm notoriously bad.
It's a little bit different. I think Hira's is I think there is a little bit of an impediment in his swing. I think the problem with Black in Eric's article was more that it's already a high effort swing. Like he's already putting a lot into it. It's not an easy swing. It's not a fluid swing. And so if you have a hole that exists already that requires catching up or something like that, it probably takes some, like, it's going to take a material change rather than just like faster eye, faster swing. Like, you're not going to be able to up what he does already. He's tapped out.
And there was an article in the JS, I think it was over a week ago now. So I think it was Rosiak when he was still down there, was talking about an interesting thing. They're having to force Tyler Black to back off. Because he's one of these guys who's like, he just wants to get in the cage and just keep working and working and working. And it's not necessarily like leading to improvements. What they're trying to get him to do is like, no, we're going to limit you to 20 swings in the cage. And we really want you to focus on these specific things to work and try to improve on those things. Because it sounds like he's one of those guys who like will just stay in there all day if you let him, to the point where, you know, it's not actually, you know, productive.
It's not focused practice. It's not, you know, measured practice. It's just going out there and swinging over and over again. And that can do more damage than help if the lessons aren't being learned correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. You like to see the effort. You obviously like to have a guy who just wants to get better and wants to keep going. Like, that is a good sign. That's good stuff. But you have to like learn how to focus it and figure out what is actually going to improve. So yeah, the Tyler Black thing is wild because I just look at his numbers from last year and that he's putting these up at AA and AAA. Absolutely fantastic numbers. Absolutely fantastic numbers. And Longenhagen does acknowledge in there that, you know, he has an insanely advanced idea of the strike zone. So he has that skill set working for him. It's just that the rest of it is going to be kind of problematic and he's going to have to work at it. So we will see. Tyler Black is also, you know, fits right into this this narrative at third base where it's like, it could be so many things. We just don't know. This is a season to try to, you know, figure out what Tyler Black is.
All right. Second question about third base here comes from Dave Penshorn on Patreon asking, what do we think about JD Davis at third instead of Monasterio? Saw he was just put on waivers by the Giants after they signed Chapman. Secondly, how is Devin Williams lower ranked than David Bednar in MLB The Show by a significant margin? Outrageous. Well, I don't know if MLB The Show knew that Devin Williams was maybe going to have back problems. That's kind of scary, but we'll talk more about that next week. But Paul, JD Davis, what do we think?
He's good. I would do that. I don't have a sense of what he's going to cost, for one thing. But like,
he was just released, so probably free, right? Presumably so, not I mean, much. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I feel like he's also just kind of spaghetti. Like JD Davis has had a few decent seasons recently, but they've been cut off by injury or like the COVID season, which I don't count. So there is a smattering of good play in there, but he doesn't see a lot of time and he's on the older side. And so like, I might just rather go with the spaghetti we already have. But you know, if he's cheap as all get out and you want to take a crack at it, all right, I'd be fine with it. But I don't find him terribly exciting.
Yeah, I think I echo that too. It's interesting because he was a guy who was being talked about last week a lot because when Matt Chapman was brought in, he was displacing him. And did you know that JD Davis also lost his starting position to Matt Chapman in college?
Oh, goodness, that poor guy.
So he's got to just feel like...
It's like Newman. Yeah, it's like Chapman.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I think he would be spaghetti. One thing, I assumed he was really, really bad defensively, and actually... apparently he got to the point where he's pretty playable at third base. So like defensively, it's because that was going to be my initial reaction here was like, oh no, we don't want that defense, but apparently it's not terrible. So, I don't know. This would be spaghetti and it would further complicate things, but like, I kind of want to see more of what we have and work through the things we already have and see how that works as opposed to bringing in a stopgap who can potentially be, just like fine and a fill-in and a perfectly cromulent third baseman, but doesn't really advance us in our knowledge of where we're going to be going forward with this team. You know what I mean? Right. So
also virtually no platoon splits on the guy. So even situationally, like not that useful. If they signed JD Davis, I'd be like, yeah, right, fine. Let's see what he's got. But I just barely care about it, I guess is all.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fair. It's like, I would not be upset one bit, but I'm also just not excited about it because I do kind of want to see our own. We have a lot of guys and I want to see what they can do. And JD Davis is sort of a known, I don't say mediocrity, but a
he
known.
He does have some versatility. And if you did want, like, I don't know how his defense is over at first base, but if you did want a guy who could pop over there and like when Hoskins' glove needs to come out, that might be somewhat useful and still keep a decent bat in there. So like, again, not the worst idea, just like, he's just kind of a guy.
Yeah.
No, I'm with Paul. We have spaghetti at home. Just leave it there. All right. Heading to the outfield. Let's start in left field where the Brewers again led all of baseball in 2023 with 5.9 Fangraphs WAR and a 297, 384, 482 overall hitting line. That's insane.
It is insane. How did that happen?
So Ryan, we were talking earlier, right? Like it just everyone they plugged into left field just mashed.
I think it was a case of because that's where Tyrone Taylor was playing late in the season when he got hot. Remember he had August and September where he was putting up like a 1000 OPS.
Yeah.
Yep. That was why. And so when Yelich was going to the bench, anytime Yelich would go to the bench, Sal Frelick must've had some good games over there. Like basically if you filled in left field, you had a really good offensive game. If you filled in right field, you had an absolutely terrible game, which we're going to get to in a minute, but yeah.
Yeah, so this year, Fangraphs only projecting them to get 2.3 wins above replacement there this year, amounting to their biggest anticipated drop positionally in 2024. That's kind of interesting. Should we be expecting that free fall from Yelich in the position generally, Paul? Or I don't know. I feel like there's just so many guys, again, they could shuffle in there that it should still be relatively strong to me.
I think that the discussion we just had is probably the best explanation for why that projection is probably close to accurate. What's the Joe Pita term? The cluster luck was with the left field. And so I think the way to judge this mostly is off of the Yelich base. And yeah, he'll do some DHing and some other stuff and miss time because he's an old man at this point. But I feel like that's about right. And that's kind of how it should be split up when everything's said and done. I suspect Yelich takes, you know, a little step back again, or hits about the same as he did before. Still gets on base. Powers, well, probably takes a step back. He actually had pretty good power last year. I don't think that will. If he hits 19 home runs again, I'll be actually through the moon. That would be lovely. And 34 doubles. But I think they do come back to earth. I think he also comes back to earth a little bit. And so 2.1 is probably about right.
Yeah. So give me the over on that number. I think it's going to be closer to three. Maybe I could see it being well over three too. Give me the over on that number, just because I think Yelich is still a pretty good hitter. What he did last year was a pretty nice return to form for the Marlins days. Obviously, we're not getting 2018-19 MVP Yelich back. Like, that guy's, I think we could say pretty safely now, gone for good. But
yeah, that guy's dead.
Yeah, like, that's not coming back. But I still think we've got something here in Yelich. And I also, just the other factor here is, if Yelich does see more and more time at DH, I think that probably hints towards, I guess, Sal Frelick seeing a decent amount of time in left field. And I think that he would also be, whoever they put out there is going to be good defensively, because they don't have bad defensive outfielders. We might also see some Churio in left field. Like, that might be the thing. We did get some talk this week when Jackson Churio had his three for three game. The comment from Pat Murphy coming out of that game was, we'd like to see him play better in the outfield. So you could potentially see Churio see some time in left field, where I think he would be exceptional as well. So I think the defensive floor in left is sky high, because all of their outfielders are good defensively. And I think that anybody they play over there is probably going to, you know, hit at least a reasonable amount. So I think they'll be the over on this. But yeah, they're not going to get that almost six F war out of that position the way they did last year. That seems, like, it would be extremely unlikely. Yelich would basically have to turn back into MVP Yelich for that to happen.
All right, yeah, let's hop over to right field, because as we mentioned, left fielders mashed, right fielders did not. The team put up I can't even believe this is real, a 63 WRC plus as right fielders last year. The exceptional defense that they did get out of the position, thanks to, you know, the likes of Joey Weimer, some Blake Perkins out there, did manage to push their Fangraphs WAR in right all the way up to 26th. With 0.4, but I think it's a safe bet, just given the outfield depth and some of the guys that you talked about in left also being possibilities for right. They should definitely improve there this year, right, Paul?
Yes, they should. They should get a dead cat bounce, if nothing else. But it's worth mentioning that Weimer plays a lot out there when they have other center fielders, because his arm is amazing and he is a drag on the offense. Maybe he will take a step forward. He's been working with a new swing and he's certainly got a lot of raw power, but I wouldn't be surprised if he still can't really hit very well. So there's that. But I do think you get a little bit of a boost from probably Churio playing across the board a little bit, just to get him in, including over in right. You probably get Garrett Mitchell for however long he can stay healthy playing over there occasionally as well. And so you probably do just get regression to the mean, because that was atrocious last year. And frickin' Winker was out there for a whole bunch of time. Yeah. He's one of the worst regulars in baseball. So you're gonna improve on that, I think, almost for sure, even if it is a worse offensive position than the left side is.
Did Winker get a lot of time in right? I thought it was mostly DH.
He did. I still think of him as a crappy right fielder, but he probably was most.
Yeah,
he might have like one or two games out there.
Yeah. The thing about Weimer is, if you limit him to just hitting against lefties, he put up an 815 OPS against lefties last year. So if you can just, if he is in a platoon, I think there's a use for him in that role. And that actually represented, he got really cold at the end of the season. And he was up in the nines for most of the year in terms of where he was.
Winker did play right field for one inning last year. So.
For one inning. Okay. He got out there for one inning.
Yep. And they were like, that's enough of that. Yeah.
Yeah. That'll be, and that's enough of that. But Yeah, the thing about Weimer is if he's going to be a long-term part of this team, obviously that 568 OPS against right-handed pitchers, not going to work, especially since right-handers make up, you know, three-quarters of the pitchers in Major League Baseball. So he's going to have to get better at that. But I think there's a role for him. I think that especially this Sal Frelick at third thing is probably the best news Joey Weimer could hope to hear in terms of getting...
Absolutely.
Yeah, like an opening day roster spot, because that does, you know, open up the outfield a little bit more potentially for him to be able to do that. So I'm a Weimer guy, and I am optimistic that he is going to figure some things out. He was, you know, James Anderson and I talked about this a lot on the Minor League Pod. We were pretty convinced that he was going to have a strikeout rate, you know, catastrophically bad, like a Garrett Mitchell bad, you know, like in the mid 30s. And he ended up, you know, only at 28% strikeout rate, which is very manageable and not that bad last year. So he was doing some things right. And he does have a good feel for the strike zone. That is one thing he does. And he's obviously just, you know, crazy athletic, you know, completely tooled up. So he has some things going for him. It's all about that swing. And can this new swing, can he find a groove, and will it work for him, and will he be able to get comfortable and start doing good things with that swing? It's really all about that for Weimer. And I'm going to maintain cautious optimism about it for now.
All right. In center field, obviously, all eyes may be on Jackson Chourio there, depending on how much he plays center as opposed to left and right, as you guys mentioned. Last year, they were pretty much middle of the pack in center field, 3.3 Fangraphs WAR, that ranked 12th in the majors. But Fangraphs is anticipating a bit of a step down this year to 2.1 WAR being projected for the position and 24th in the majors. A lot of that has to do with how much playing time and the projection they're giving to Jackson Chourio, who, as we all need to remind ourselves, is only 20 years old this year and is being projected for 1.6 WAR. So I guess, Paul, is that a reasonable place to start for expectations for Chourio this year?
It probably is. Just we're working off of projection systems here for starters, and projection systems have trouble with outliers, generally speaking, and Chourio is likely to be one of those. But that being said, even if that's true, he is 20, and 20-year-olds usually don't light us up with 5 WAR seasons. It doesn't happen very often. So that probably is a reasonable place to start, and that projection is probably not terrible. The one thing you know the Brewers will get is elite center field defense. And while we've talked about good defense at all the outfield positions, center field is where you can drive the most value from your defensive contribution just based on the amount of space you have to cover. So that's good. Everybody's elite. Garrett Mitchell's elite. Weimer is elite. Chourio is probably elite as well. Even Blake Perkins is an elite outfielder defensively. So the floor there is fantastic. It's just a matter of if anybody can hit. You've got a ton of upside with Chourio, and I'd say Mitchell too, actually. That was, I think, probably fake last year, but I do think there's still a puncher's chance there's something there offensively for him if he can make contact. But, you know, there's a downside to all this too, which is that none of these guys might hit. So I think that projection is probably good. I'll take the over on it because I do believe in Chourio and that he'll actually put up pretty decent value pretty quickly. But I think it's a reasonable spot that they put him at.
Yeah, I think it's a good cautious estimate, and it is really important to note. Yeah, Jackson Chourio, literally, happy birthday, Jackson. He just turned 20 last week.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a guy who's not just 20, but like a young 20, you know, going into the season. So he is still very much a baby here, and we need to just manage our expectations. This is going to be a big thing to not get too excited, not get too over our skis here. He did have a good week offensively. He had been off to kind of a slow start in camp insofar as, you know, we care about these things, which is minimally, but he did have a good week offensively. And so that the numbers definitely look a lot better right now than they did coming into the week. But we're going to need to see the power actually is kind of the thing that is going to determine, you know, if he's actually a really good player this first year. It's going to kind of come down to how much power can he hit for. And I think he's going to hit for power long term. I'm not sure how much it's going to be this year. So, yeah, I think, like I already said, I think we're going to see some Chourio in left field as well, especially if Garrett Mitchell does show out and is a guy that you want on the field. I think Garrett Mitchell is going to see – some time in center field, because his center field defense is truly spectacular. Like, he might be one of the very best defensive center fielders in all of baseball, along with who's the guy in Philly now, who just came up. Yeah, Mitchell might be truly, truly elite defensively in center field. So
that leads us to our next Patreon question. Comes from JD. What's the best outfield combo they can run out on a daily basis? So plenty of mixing and matching, as we talked about. But I guess, are you talking offensively, defensively, overall, Paul? What do you think?
It really probably depends a lot on pitching matchup, but generally speaking, it's probably Churio if you get, you know, good to great Churio in center. Yelich, still putting up, you know, good, he's still going to be one of the best offensive players, even if he is, you know, lesser Yelich. And then it depends on if Frelick's playing third, I guess, because I think I'd put him as the next best outfielder. And so I guess I'd go with that, but there's so many ways you can mix and match the outfielders, including playing them on the infield, that it's kind of a tricky question, because you actually lose some, like, if you're playing Frelick in the outfield, you're not playing him at third base. You're playing Monasterio at third base, which is worse, or maybe Tyler Black at third base, which is maybe worse and maybe better. So you got knock-on effects, but I'll still go with Churio, Yelich, and Frelick as the three I'd run out there.
Yeah, honestly, some of this might come down to, is there a guy or is there a team that's going to roll a lot of balls over to third base? Because if that's the case, maybe you don't want Frelick over there and you'd rather have him in the outfield. So it comes down to, like, how heavily a ground ball matchup is this? I think the answer, JD, is really actually there isn't one. I think this is going to be a mix and match situation. I think guys are going to move around. I think you're going to see guys get extensive run in a lot of different positions. I think Churio is going to see time in center and left. I think Weimer's going to see time in right and center, probably left as well. I think, you know, Mitchell's going to see time in right and center. And Yelich is the only one who's not going to see regular, you know, time anywhere other than just like one position. If you're going to move them around and they're going to go by sort of what the matchup dictates and what, you know, who's healthy and who's hitting. So I think you're going to see a lot of mixing and matching, which is, you know, it's the Brewer way. This is how things have been run by the Brewers for the last decade now, and it's held them in very good stead. So I wouldn't expect to really see that change just because Pat Murphy is now the manager. I think they'll mix and match quite a bit.
All right, finally, we're on to DH, where the Brewers were absolutely brutal last year. Thank you, Jesse Winker. Negative 1.6 Fangraphs WAR. Dead last in 2023, but where they're projected to finish is 20th this year, all the way up to 1.1 Fangraphs WAR in 2024. Some of that may be dead cat bounce, as Paul was saying earlier, with some other positions. But I guess, Paul, what players do you see getting the most games at DH in 24? Because as we mentioned, basically with everything, there's going to be plenty of rotation with that spot.
Yeah. I think that projection is probably about right, because I think it'll be a lot of Hoskins, a lot of Yelich, and then a lot of catchers. And amongst the Brewers players, those are all pretty good hitters. So cobbling them together at DH gets you a pretty good DH number. I'll actually take the over on that for that reason. I think, generally speaking, they'll probably have a pretty decent bat playing DH every day and probably enjoying the platoon split every time they do it. So I think that they're actually unusually well set up at designated hitter for like the first time that I can remember. seems like it's always bad. This should actually be pretty good, I think.
Yeah, Fangraphs depth charts, again, the roster resource depth charts, does have the two catchers as the top DH plate appearance getters. They have Gary Sanchez getting 168 and Contreras getting 161. And I could see that being true, but they also have both Yelich getting 140 and Rhys Hoskins getting 119. So they have four different guys projected for 119 or more. And that does feel right. I think this is going to be a mix and match situation. And I like all of those guys as hitters. They're all above average big league hitters. And, you know, that's what you want at DH, because you should have an above average hitter at DH. So I think this is pretty good. The thing about the WAR part of it is it's the WAR calculations for DH are just very difficult. Like Fangraphs, Meg talks about this on Effectively Wild a lot, that like it's just really hard to do, because they hit you so hard for not doing anything positionally and just like what the replacement level at DHs is so high in terms of what you have to do offensively. So, yeah, we will see.
All right, that'll do it for the position breakdowns, but we do have plenty of other Patreon questions to get to. Let's start with Joey, who is writing in here on Patreon saying, by my count, Zips has 5 Brewers players projected to have a WRC plus over 100. Hoskins, Contreras, Adamas, Yelich, and Black. Who's the one guy not on that list we think will finish above league average? Paul, what do you think?
I'd probably actually take Churio just on the upside. Like, he's young and I think he will likely struggle, but I think there's a pretty good chance that he hits better than average. So that would be my answer there, I think.
I would say Frelick has an excellent chance to do it as well, as does Gary Sanchez. As does Gary Sanchez. So I think both of those guys have the chance because Gary Sanchez last year put up, he was like 111, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
He was above average at that position. Yeah. So I think, you know, both of those guys have a pretty good chance. I think they might actually on some days have 6-7 guys who are above average offensively in the lineup, which is going to be a change from where we've been the last few years.
Moving on, Michael Parr asking, how patient will the Brewers be with the youngsters if they aren't hitting? It seemed as if last year they were running Weimer or Turang out there every day despite their offensive struggles because they had no other options, but there's a legitimate backup at every slot this year. Paul, what do you think?
So last year, a lot of that, like Weimer playing so much, was caused mainly by injuries. Mm-hmm. That'll probably happen this year again at some point. Injuries are part of baseball, and so they will have a lot of patience during those times. But the thing is, all of the young kids' backups on this team are also young kids. And so I think that they will be mixing and matching and playing matchups and just getting people enough time to develop and keep everybody healthy that there's not going to be a situation where you want a guy out there every single day and have to live through him struggling. Like, that situation doesn't really exist. Like, if Bryce Turang is out there and he stinks up the joint for a week, well, he probably won't play a whole week in a row, but he would probably just get 2 days off while Ortiz played, and vice versa. Like, if Ortiz has a similar thing, like, that's just how it'll be. Like, they'll rest, relax, and work on stuff in the cages while the other young guys go out there and do it. And I'm sure they'll ride hot streaks to some extent and lean more heavily, but this isn't like a guy's a starter and then is bad and gets benched. This is like a guy goes from playing like 75% of the time to playing like 33% of the time. That's how this is going to work this year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they were stuck in large part because of some injuries that hit them and kind of stacked up on them at points last year, especially in the outfield, Tyron Taylor and Mitchell both being hurt early on. Luis Urias, remember, he was supposed to be like the starting second baseman. And the fact that he got hurt on literally opening day meant that Bryce Turang was forced into action and playing on a regular basis a lot sooner than he otherwise would have. That does happen. You're right. Injuries are part of all sports. Learning that with Liverpool this year, good God. But it is probably going to be less stick with the same guys because, like you said, there's just more guys here. We didn't even mention, really, we haven't talked about it much, but Oliver Dunn, as a guy who could potentially step in and play at a couple of these different positions as well, or move other guys around and add to that with, you know, Monasterio and Turang and all these guys. I think they will move things around, and people who are struggling will probably see the bench a little bit more quickly than where they were last year. And some of that is good in terms of this year. But there's also a, you know, if you end up falling out of it this year, then you do kind of just want to, like, if you're trending to be, you know, a 78 win team in August, I want to see at that point all of the kids playing. Like, that's where this is time to start getting them into the lineup and really start letting them play and see where you're at. So it sort of depends on your level of competitiveness too, right? Like, where you are in the standings is going to dictate some of these decision-making processes as well.
Mark Pod Scarby, our next question on Patreon, asking, your discussion last week on Jake Bowers got me thinking. Did the Brewers make a mistake here and misread the first base market when they made this trade? They gave up a top 30 prospect and another lottery ticket for him, yet Bowers has no real path to playing time if everyone is healthy and he's also out of options. Ryan, what are your thoughts on the Jake Bowers situation?
No. These guys they gave up, yes, it is possible that Jay Savina and Brian Sanchez end up doing something at the big league level at some point. But I got to point out here, neither of them made the Yankees top 30 this spring. Don't worry about having given these guys up. I don't know why there was consternation about having given these guys up. It's just not a thing. Jake Bowers, you're much more likely to get something useful out of Jake Bowers than you are out of Jay Savina and Brian Sanchez. Even if it's none of that is very likely at all. So no, there's no reason to worry about this. It's fine. It's fine. He is, if nothing else, he's some depth that they have in spring training, and also just gave them like a floor to work with in terms of, you know, have they not been able to get Rhys Hoskins? I think they wanted to get Rhys Hoskins the whole way, but that wasn't necessarily a guarantee. Giving up Jay Savina and Brian Sanchez is not a thing that you need to lose sleep over. It's fine.
Yeah, Jake Bowers is terrible. My other assumption is they probably saw something they maybe thought they could tweak a little bit with him, mm-hmm. and just got him to see if they could. But like, the whole thing is a big nothing burger, and you know, is he the last guy on the roster? He's probably not quite the last guy on the roster. He's probably the third last guy on the roster. So, I mean, who cares?
Yeah.
On the 40, sorry, third last guy on the 40 man.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Price Trozen asking, is Wes Clark the number one three true outcomes prospect in the system with his name and how he looks? Wes looks like what you'd get if you type three true outcomes into an AI generator. Maybe, you know, it come out with three or four missing fingers. But yeah, Wes Clark, obviously, you know, we talked about him when we talked about Zips and they had like the wild 20 home run projection, obviously roster resource projection, a little bit more realistic on what he's actually going to be playing this year. But obviously he's flashed some power earlier in spring, Ryan.
Yeah, he has the four home runs. He also has 10 strikeouts and 21 at-bats. So and he hasn't actually taken a walk yet, which is weird because he is a walker. So that part of it is not like in keeping, but maybe it does tell you a little bit that like, at least at this point, teams have not been afraid of Wes Clark. They've been challenging him. He has been punishing them a little bit. And how long that would continue, I don't know. It's just, we've talked about Wes Clark a bunch on here before. And James and I have talked because we always get questions about him. He has an incredibly tough road to hoe in terms of being a righty-righty guy with like a strikeout rate in the mid-30s. That's an incredibly tough bar he's going to have to clear because he's a first base only, first base slash DH. So the bar for his offense is so astronomically high. He's a fun story, and I don't begrudge rooting for him or whatever, but the chance that he is going to be anything other than like an emergency stopgap at some point as a major league player is very low.
Yep. Echo all of that. Have nothing to add.
All right. My Only Lemonade. Next question. I was happy to see the announcement that Jenny Kavnar was promoted to the primary play-by-play announcer for the Oakland A's this season. The first woman to hold this position in MLB history. Incredible and long overdue. Who would you like to see take the reins after BA and Rock finally give up their chairs? Seems certain that Jeff Levering will slide over to TV full time, but is there any chance that Sophia Minert gets a shot, assuming that she wants it, of course? Paul, I don't know what Sophia wants in her career. She's very good at what she does, yeah. But what do you think is next after this generation?
I don't know. I do like Levering pretty well, but I think that's probably right there. I don't like a lot of their current backups as announcers, so I hope that they get some fresh blood in and that Tim Dillard is consigned to some other universe somewhere at some point. But I mean, I don't have a roster of announcers. I watch all games on mute. I think we've mentioned several
famously
times
on yes
podcasts. So I kind of have literally no opinion on this at all. Once Euchre's gone, I guess I will care because of the radio, but like I usually watch games in silence, so I don't know.
So yeah, I think Levering is the guy who, I mean, honestly, for the last couple of years now, he's done way more games than Brian Anderson has.
Yes, he has.
He's doing 100 plus games a year on the TV side at this point. So that is his gig, really, more so than it is Brian Anderson, who just parachutes in. I always had defended Anderson, basically until last year, when it really seemed like in the past he had seemed connected to the team, like he knew what was going on. He had, you know, been clearly watching games and was like in the flow of the season. Last year, for the first time, he really felt like he was just parachuting in. And if that's the case, yeah, it's time. Like, Brian Anderson has been very, very good for the Brewers, and it's been a good run with him. So it's fine, though. Like, go do – you have a bunch of high-profile gigs doing other stuff in other places. Like, it's fine. Go do those things. It really is okay. And the other thing is, if he wanted to come back and just be like the Brewers full-time guy again, that would also be fine. But that's not the way this is going. So like, that ship has sailed. I like Rotino much more over Dillard. Give me Rotino. I really did like Rotino. They were running a three-man booth this spring on TV. They had Rotino and Rock with Jeff Levering. And I thought that it actually, we talked about this a little last week, didn't we? That it canceled out a little bit of the of the bad, having the other one there. And so I'm fine with going with a three-man booth there. That would be fine. I will mention, this is like a kind of a shot in the dark, because he's almost been kind of like advocating for it, or like seeming to push for it. Ryan Spielborgs, who was a Madison Mallard. I know because a friend of mine has his bobblehead from the Madison Mallards. Like in the early days of the Madison Mallards, he was there and he played in the big leagues for a while for the Rockies. And he has done some occasional booth color commentary. I'm looking at his wiki page right now, and he was on the Apple broadcast on Friday night. He seems like he could potentially be a guy. I think he kind of would like to do it. I think from what I've heard, and I've heard some like interviews and things with him otherwise, I think I would like Ryan Spielborgs. I'm not 100% sure. Don't like tie me down to that, but I think that might be a possibility down the road. So
we kind of glossed over Sophia. Has she ever done like radio? Or the thing is, like, she's good at that, but the filling time for 3 hours is a very different job.
Well, and also just like her role would be different. And usually, I'm not going to say always, but usually to be an analyst, most analysts played like high level either baseball, or like Jessica Mendoza for ESPN played high level softball. Usually analysts have some sort of high end playing experience. And I'm not sure, but I don't think that was her. So I don't think she had that. It doesn't necessarily negate like the possibility of it, but usually people that come like from like that side of things, it would be more likely that they would do like play by play as opposed to the analyst job, because they're different gigs.
Yep. Not against it. Not against having a woman in the booth for sure. Just I was trying to think of somebody local with like the sort of normal skill set, and I'm having trouble coming up. I'm coming up with a blank on it. So
yeah, the opportunities for women in most of these roles. Well, you see it like with basketball. There are a lot more women who are analysts in basketball because there's been such a long-standing tradition of high-end women's basketball where people have like played and have done things that have like gotten them, because this is what it Howard Cosell famously called it, like the jockocracy, right? That like we give these announcing jobs to former jocks as opposed to people who are actually competent. And that's maybe less true than it used to be, but yeah, I think it still holds a lot of sway. They still look for, when they're talking about analysts, it's almost always a former athlete on some level. Almost all always. Right.
Steve S. has our next question, asking, last year it was the Cheesehead, Before that, the Bell, the Infinity Gauntlet, Rally Rabbit, Gus the Dog. If you could decide what item they went with this year, ridiculous or practical, your choice. What are you going with for the home run celebration, Paul?
They should print out a mask of the Craig Council meme.
Yes. Oh, I'm 100% on board with this.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah. Just do that. Yeah. Put the Craig Council face on after everyone. Right? Any other ideas?
Yeah, no, that these things, it has to be stupid. It has to be organic. So this has to bubble up from like something that they're doing, you know, whatever. Some of my favorites that other teams have done, somebody had a really ugly jacket that you got to put on after you hit a home run. I liked that. Yeah, like kind of a Masters jacket, but like really ugly. I guess the Masters jacket's pretty ugly too. But but that's kind of the point. So they have like that. It has to be organic. It has to spring up from the team. And it should be something really stupid too. Like the dumber, the better in these cases. Yeah, like it.
Absolutely.
It really should be stupid.
We'll see what they come up with shortly. All right. Ian Pomplin, our next question, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation because I'm not a Dune guy. Who is the Lasan Al-Gaib of the Brewers? Paul, we were talking. This is tricky for you to answer given spoilers and such.
I'm just going to go with it was Council is the answer.
Okay.
Okay. I have not seen these. I have not seen these movies yet, so I cannot. Amy gave me a little bit of a rundown because I asked her. I'm like, tell me who I should say here. She was suggesting Churio, but I don't know that that's actually. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess spoiler free discussion here for you. But Paul knows a lot more about Dune than the rest of us.
I do not.
compared to me and James,
I know a small amount more about Dune than the rest of you. That's all.
Which is more than we actually know. All right, Tricky Henderson, last question on this episode, asking, as fans, are we suitably appreciative for the brand of baseball we get with our recent and current Brewers? Sure, the Phils, Dodgers, and Rangers go all 90s Blue Jays on free agents, but money is their most creative resource, and that's like saying a painter's best trait is her canvas. I'm not saying the Stearns-Arnold era is throwing down Basquiat's, but I think our weird manipulations approach to the brilliance of Jasper Johns, perhaps. If only to myself, I say, step back and admire the work while it's in front of me. Or, as noted art critic and alleged second baseman Ricky Weeks once said, let's fucking go. All right.
I'm not an art guy. I'm aware of Jasper Johns.
I know much more about these people than Dune. So,
Well, you take it then, Paul. Go ahead.
Basquiat should be higher. That's correct. Let's see. Well, the question's really more just about the aesthetics of the team itself. The comps are fine. And I don't know that I would say that we take it for granted, because while they've been successful and while they are very clever about working within what is, we call them cheap, but they're not super cheap. A lot of other teams are cheaper. They're like a middle spending team. They've played a lot of boring, ugly, garbage baseball that I hate watching over the last 5 years, too, where they strike out a billion times and don't score any runs till the eighth inning rolls around and just lock everything down, pitching and off and on defense. And that is, I would say, the art wing that has a lot of sort of like melting faces, it's sort of like an avant-garde absurdist display of baseball a lot of the time, where it works and there's clearly a lot that's gone into it, but it's actually kind of off-putting, and you need to be in the right mood to actually appreciate it. So I would actually like some better hitting than we've had lately. So that would be nice. Sometimes you just want to go see the Mona Lisa, and we can't pay for that. I understand that. But, you know, you can have something in a similar vein on the team as well. It doesn't all have to be, I'm out-clevering everybody all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny. I like that he compares it and says that, like, talking about money as, like, the painter's canvas, which I guess is is not a bad analogy there. So that's kind of interesting. It's weird because they are, they're very smart and in how they choose to spend, because they are not wanting to get themselves into bad situations and lock themselves up. And they haven't. They've kept themselves free of having to really be forced by payroll considerations into, you know, doing a bunch of bad things that they otherwise wouldn't do. And that is much more common than I think people realize. The Brewers got themselves into that in the first part of Mark's tenure under Doug Melvin at a couple of different points, where like they just simply they ran out of spendable money that they had and didn't have a good enough core. So they had to, that's why they ended up tearing down in 2014, 2015, really 2015. That's why they ended up pulling the plug on it, because they got themselves into that situation where just it wasn't working. And so they had to take that step back. So you want to avoid those things where possible, but it's also, yeah, like the aesthetics of it, because that's kind of what he's getting at here, is like the aesthetics of it. I don't know. Aren't we all supposed to, like, as like, if you're listening to this podcast, you're clearly a hardcore baseball fan. Aren't hardcore baseball fans all supposed to really appreciate pitching and defense? Isn't that supposed to be like, yeah, we're the ones that really get that? It's the casuals who hate that or like need the home runs or whatever. But I also just, like, that's like the stereotype of what it's supposed to be. But I don't feel like that's actually true. Like, I would rather watch, you know, a good, interesting offense, or at least dangerous offense, where you, yeah, where you are, the possibility exists of like big breakouts and good things that way. And it, at too many points over the last few years, it has seemed like that those possibilities just were like closed off to us.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it feels like rooting for the Chicago Bears, right? Because in their good seasons, and when they go 13-3, the defense is great and the offense is trash and every game is painful.
Right.
I hate that.
Bring me a Klaus Oldenburg, a commentary on pop culture that is also representative of pop culture itself and can be appreciated by fans of both sides.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
I have no idea what you just said, but I agree. Thank you.
Klaus Oldenburg's famous for making sculptures of what are basically large versions of everyday objects. Spatulas, pencils. He did the Cherry Spoon Bridge in Minneapolis.
I was going to say, was that him? The Cherry Spoon Bridge, I know. I was there. We went with my mother-in-law, and she really hated modern art. Like, it was really funny. I had so much fun, like, listening to her talk, because she just, like, gunned on it the whole time, and it was great. I was like, I didn't particularly find it that great either. I'm not a huge modern art guy, so. But I did enjoy her just, like, insulting everything as we were seeing it. Like, oh, this is so stupid. Why is this here? What is the point of this? What is this yard hanging on the wall for? It was great. I loved it.
Love that. Take her to MoMA in New York. Yeah. All right. Thanks for the questions, everybody. Thanks for sticking through the supersized offensive preview. We'll tackle pitching next week when we join again. No new patrons to shout out, but a reminder, go to patreon.com/MKETailgate to sign up. $2 a month gets you question priority. Ryan will put out the call for questions for the pitching side next weekend as well before we do this. Until then, I guess let's see how the next week goes. Hopefully Devin Williams doesn't have like a chronic back injury that we need to talk about next week. That would be fun. All right. We'll wrap things up there. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you here next time on Milwaukee's Tailgate. Stay well.